subject. Now, when we speak about our martyrs, Sayyid Abbas Musawi, Shaykh Raghib Harab, and Haj Imad Mughniyi, and when we speak about their personalities, about their behavior, we find common ground between these three figures. We find that the description is almost carbon copy between these three officials. Faith, of course, decency, love, loving one another, love for people, sympathy, love for one's country. All of these people, of course, share these values. We can understand how someone can be extreme and merciful at the same time. When we look at these three personalities, how can someone fight for his country at the same time and cry like a child when he sees the bodies of the martyrs in the Qana massacre and the massacres which occurred in Lebanon, other massacres which occurred in Lebanon? So there is a lot of common similarities. There is a lot of common ground between these three figures. We also have to look at one common element or one common factor, which is the factor that all of these three martyrs were young to a certain level. Our brothers, these three figures, were vigilant at the very beginning. They were vigilant concerning the conflict with the Zionist entity, concerning Al-Quds, Jerusalem and Palestine. And they were raised in this environment, whether it, of course, Imam Musa Sadr also was with them at that time, and they learned from Imam Musa Sadr's teachings. Now, from the very beginning, as I said, these three figures strived to take responsibility, strived to take part in all of these efforts of jihad and these efforts of sacrifice for the sake of the causes of Jerusalem and Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque. From the very beginning, these three figures were men. Even when they were young, when they were boys, they were young, they were men. They behaved like men. They didn't play around like normal children, of course. They did not live a normal life like any simple child or any simple person. They were men, as I said, ever since they were small children. And they remained men until the very last day of their lives. And God chose for each of these people his own direction and his own role. God chose the path for each one of them. Shaykh Raghib Harab was the beginning of the popular intifada or popular revolution. He showed the true meaning of perseverance and the revolution of women and children, and he was the true meaning of peaceful resistance, and he was the one who refused to shake the hands of the enemy or to smile to the enemy or to accept the presence of the enemy. And his blood laid the foundations for the victories of the resistance in the aftermath. And Sayyid Abbas al-Musawi, the former Hezbollah Secretary General, also played a role in establishing the resistance from the jihadist perspective. And he, as a former Secretary General of Hezbollah, was the leader of this party, and he was the leader of the military operations of this party, of Hezbollah, and he held firmly on to the ideology on which the martyrs walked or on which the martyrs depended. He was leader of jihad. He always spoke honestly, and he always, of course, honored the blood of the martyrs, and he translated tactically, militarily, in all different fields, in all different military fields, he translated and manifested the pains of those who suffered and those who were oppressed by the occupation and by the military campaigns which were launched in this country. These brothers, each one of them, spent all their time, all their prime years in resistance, from the intellectual perspective or from the populist perspective or from the military perspective. So all of their lives were devoted to resistance. They all, of course, fell as martyrs at a very young age. I, just like you, when I see the pictures, I remember a lot. Of course, Sheikh Raghib Harb was killed at the age of 32, a very young age. Sayyid Abbas al-Musawi, the former Hezbollah Secretary General, was killed at 40 years of age. And Imad Bughniyeh was killed when he was 46 years of age. And I said, and even another high-ranking figure in this ummah said that Hajj Imad Bughniyeh lived a lot, lived a long, blessed life. Yes, it is good for Imad Bughniyeh to live 46 years. This by itself is an achievement. These brothers, as I said, fell as martyrs at a very young age, and we here are looking at an example. These three figures have set an example for vigilance, vigilance from a young age, people who take responsibility and spend their days in serious work, in serious efforts to serve God and to serve their people and their cause. As I said before, from a very young age, ever since they were children, they shed their blood and they sacrificed. They sacrificed with their blood for the sake of God and for the sake of their ummah and their people. They did this for the sake of helping people live a life of dignity, live a life of honor, a life in a secure atmosphere. And these young leaders were also able to find or leave behind them generations of youngsters who carried their resistance and carried the burden of resistance on their own two shoulders and fought and fell as martyrs and showed perseverance and brought about victories and made huge achievements. And they gave and still are giving to us by their thinking, by their culture, by their blood, by their mere memory. They are giving to us more and more generations of youngsters who represent today one of the most important advantages or strengths in Lebanon. These youngsters who have vigilance, youngsters who take responsibility, youngsters who are serious, youngsters who are efficient, youngsters who are ready to sacrifice, youngsters who take responsibility for their ummah and their people and their country and their sanctities and their dignity. These youngsters are the real strength which we have. They are an advantage, the most important advantage. And they were left behind. Our three leaders left behind these generations so that we can confront the future with them. On every occasion, when we commemorate the memory of these martyrs, we must take responsibility as well. We take responsibility for what they achieved. They and all the other martyrs as well, from all other factions, from different parties and factions, the army, the people, throughout long years of sacrifice and jihad, these people were able to achieve the liberation of the territories and detainees, and they imposed respect for Lebanon and its stance in the world, and they laid the foundations of the alternative which protects Lebanon. And this alternative is resistance. Of course, the message they left behind is to maintain their achievement, to preserve their achievement, which is the fruit of their lives and their efforts and their tiredness. And in the end, their achievements are the fruits of their blood, the blood which they sacrificed. The achievement which they left behind is the resistance, the spirit of resistance, the culture of resistance, the thinking, the ideology, the alternative, the presence and the strength of resistance and the capability of resistance to take responsibility. This brings us to the present. Now, of course, we are confronting many important issues and we have very important choices we must make. I'd like to speak about the current situation now. Of course, throughout the past few months, we have witnessed many threats and so many questions should be posed. Unfortunately, in Lebanon, we always go back to square one. We do not benefit from our previous experiences in Lebanon as Lebanese, nor do we benefit or take advantage of the lessons learned by other people of the world or the lessons we could learn from history. We always go back to square one and ask the same questions. Today, the same questions are being asked, the same as 1982 and after 1982 and before 1982. The exact same questions and the same alternatives are being raised. I do not want to go back to this discussion, but I'd just like to remind what these questions are. I'd like to once again remind you of these questions. Can the American promises really protect Lebanon if Obama or Biden, now we don't have Bush or Cheney, if Obama and Biden put their hands on their chests and make promises to Lebanon and say, don't be afraid, don't worry, we will protect Lebanon. Is this really what will happen? Will Obama and Biden do this? Can they do this? There is also something related to the credibility of the Obama administration concerning the settlement. Obama wasn't even able to put a stop to settlement activity. And is it true that the international resolutions can protect Lebanon? Did they protect Lebanon for 60 years? Can the international community really protect Lebanon? Did it protect Lebanon for 60 years? This international community, which is only concerned with its own interests and only respects the strong people, the strong parties, will Lebanon be protected by being neutral, not taking sides? For example, if Lebanon takes a neutral stance, can we convince Israel that it not have any greed to take over our land or our water? Can we convince Israel to return to us the Shuba farms or the Kfar Shuba hills, or to allow for the Palestinian refugees to return to their homes? Can we convince Israel by being neutral? Today we read in the newspapers that Avigdor Lieberman said that if anyone is dreaming about an agreement or a deal based upon retaining territories from Israel, anyone who believes this is dreaming, is mistaken. And his deputy, Danny Ayalon, said that there is a red line. No Palestinian refugee can return back to the occupied territories. Of course, he referred to it as Israel, not the occupied territories. He spoke about the ethical reasons for preventing the refugees from returning. Now, if Lebanon made the choice of being neutral, can it retain its territory and can it preserve its land in the future and its water in the future, and can it help in returning the Palestinian refugees to their homes and to their territories? Of course, experience tells us no. No to all these questions. The strange issue, my dear brothers and sisters, and I'm going to speak very calmly here. Maybe afterwards I might speak in a more enthusiastic manner, but now these are very delicate matters. What is strange, in Lebanon, we speak about the most obvious matters. In this earth, we have natural laws. In history and in the communities, we have natural laws and social laws, general laws. The experience of humanity says that the strong survive to confront the oppressors and the occupying forces and the hegemonic powers. History tells us that the only way to protect your dignity and to protect your land is by being strong. Weakness has no place in this world. Those who beg for protection have no place. The strong only can survive. The strong can only impose their respect on the rest of the world, and they can only achieve their aims. And if they fail, they will fall as martyrs with dignity. Can Lebanon be strong? Yes. Yes, it can. And we have proven this. We proved this by decades. Throughout the previous decades, Lebanon was able to be strong, and it was strong. And today, Lebanon remains strong. Today, Lebanon is stronger than it ever was before. Lebanon is strong, and we have an example. Many people ask us the question, in the world there is nothing like this. No, in the world there is. But on the national dialogue table we will speak about it. But don't you say that Lebanon is unique and Lebanon has many talents? Maybe this is one of its talents, to be strong, to be a strong, small country. Don't you say that Lebanon amazes people? Maybe Hezbollah or the resistance is one of the points or the issues of amazement Lebanon shows. The army, resistance and people, this is the way to challenge the threats. And this was what was ratified by the cabinet manifesto. Today, this equation and the experience has shown that this equation or this way to address the problems is the best way. And this is a choice we have made to confront these threats. We are listening to other proposals. Okay, on the table of national dialogue, when anyone presents us with another proposal, a logical proposal, which will be supported by the military experts, because of course this is something which must be shown to the experts. And if these experts provide us with another proposal other than army, people and resistance, we might accept such a proposal to confront the threats. Now, today, as I said, we are witnessing a lot of Israeli threats. How can we address this matter? I have two sets of words, one concerning the internal Lebanese situation and one concerning Israel. Now, concerning the Lebanese internal situation, at the beginning, I must express my support for the stance taken by the Lebanese officials, the Lebanese president, the parliament speaker, and the prime minister, and also the leadership of the Lebanese army. And I'd like to express my support for the majority of the Lebanese politicians and leaders of the Lebanese political parties. I would like to salute their stances because their stances reflect a refusal for the threats and also say that they will not deter to these threats. And they reflect national unity in confronting any Israeli act or any Israeli behavior. This is something which we must salute and support. I would also like to salute the efforts which are being made by the President and the Prime Minister during the trips they are taking abroad. Of course, during their trips abroad, they are highlighting the Israeli threats and the danger of these threats to Lebanon and to the region. So I'd like to thank them for these efforts as well. This is concerning the Lebanese internal situation because any responsible tone and any responsible stance is very, very, of course, important, and we must respect these stances. Second of all, concerning the Lebanese internal situation, we hear talk about alibis or excuses. They say we refuse Israeli threats, but at the same time, we don't want to give Israel an alibi or an excuse to take action against Lebanon. Now, we must clarify or address this issue. This is not true, actually. This is not feasible, this term. And it has some negative points to it. This is not the way to confront Israeli threats for many reasons. First of all, when Israel wants to fight or launch a war, it does not need any alibis and does not need any excuses. From 1948 until 1967, in all of its wars against Lebanon, even the July 2006 war, the two Israeli soldiers which were captured were not an excuse because the war had been prepared before they were captured, and Israel recognized or confessed to this. Israel does not need alibis or excuses to launch a war, and if it needs an alibi or an excuse, it can create this excuse by itself. It can organize a failed assassination attempt in any place in the world and then hold Hezbollah responsible and hence launch a war on Lebanon, or can hold the Palestinians responsible and launch another war. It might hold Syria responsible and launch a war on Syria. God only knows. So let's be calm concerning this issue of giving alibis or giving excuses to Israel, and let's be honest with the people. And actually, I'd like to express my support to the officials who spoke about Israel's wars throughout history, and they asked the question, whenever did Israel need excuses to launch a war? What is more dangerous in this rhetoric is that it holds the resistance responsible partly for any war. It holds the resistance responsible preemptively, and it's an attempt to justify for Israel any war or any military assault. So we are ready to discuss this idea with anyone to convince them that this is not logical to say don't give Israel an excuse, because it does not serve us. But let me tell you that what is the most dangerous issue is what we've heard from about 1 month ago, not just throughout these last few days. About 1 month ago, we've listened to a new language from certain parties, specific individuals or specific parties. As I said, specific individuals are saying the following. They are saying that, and this is a summary, I'm going to summarize what they say. Of course, they expressed their opinions in different means, in different ways, and they made these remarks in many different conferences and summits. But what they are saying in general is the following, these individuals. They are saying that the presence of the resistance in Lebanon, just the presence, even if the resistance doesn't do anything, whether it be on the south or not on the south, the mere presence is sufficient enough for the Israelis to launch war on Lebanon. This is what some specific individuals are saying. And so they continue and say, in order for the enemy not to have an excuse to launch a war, we must cancel out this resistance and cancel out these weapons, the weapons of resistance. From a national perspective, this language is very dangerous, because what does it mean? First of all, it means this is a justification for any Israeli military assault without the resistance giving any alibis or any excuses. The mere presence of resistance from a point of view of those individuals is enough of an excuse. Unfortunately, even the Israelis don't speak in this way. What some of the Lebanese individuals say is not being said even by some Israelis. Are there any Israeli extremists who spoke in this way? There are some, yes, but the so-called moderate Israelis said, no, this is not enough. This is not enough of an excuse. But some Lebanese say, yes, it is. So, as I said, this is very dangerous on a national level, because it justifies an Israeli military campaign completely and preemptively holds the resistance responsible 100% for any Israeli military campaign. And it seems that those Lebanese individuals are annoyed, because from July 2006 until now, nothing has happened on the borders. Of course, we have our own perspective, and I'll speak about it in other speech. Of course, now in the south, the situation is calm, nothing is happening. And so we don't want to, of course, show to them that we're giving alibis in the south, and because we didn't do anything in the south is calm. They are saying the mere presence of resistance is enough for Israel to launch a war. But the dangerous question is, and I don't want to accuse, I just want to ask a question. Are they inviting a war? Are they calling for a war, these Lebanese individuals who speak in this way? As I said, this is a justification for a war. It's as if they're saying the Israelis have justification to launch a war, as if they're saying Lebanon is giving an excuse for Israel to launch a war. Now, you might say they're mistaken, there's nothing intentional, etc., etc., but it might be the following. Are they calling for an Israeli war on Lebanon? Are they inviting an Israeli war on Lebanon? Do we go back to 1982 once again? Do some people in Lebanon find that their ambitions and their dreams and their projects, which disappeared and diminished, have no way to be achieved except by a new Israeli war on Lebanon? This is a dangerous question. Now, in light of this, what is the responsibility of the Lebanese leadership and the Lebanese government? Should the Lebanese government be silent towards those Lebanese individuals who are giving an excuse for Israel to launch a war on Lebanon and against Lebanon's infrastructure, against Lebanon's people, as the Israelis are threatening? Should the government be silent to this mistaken rhetoric, which, as I said, calls or invites for a war? I call for an end to these comments and to these remarks, because if they continue to speak in this way, this means that some people in Lebanon are waiting, and some people are depending or justifying or even calling for a new military campaign on Lebanon. And so all of these questions need answers on the national level, whether it be the government or the people. So that's concerning the Lebanese internal situation vis-a-vis the Israeli threats. And in conclusion of this subject, I'd like to say that the Lebanese official stance is excellent. The Lebanese public or popular stance is excellent. But as I said, there are specific individuals who express their stances in their own way. But there is national unity in general, if we set aside these individuals who I spoke about and referred to just now. Now, concerning the Israelis, and this is the most important part of my speech today, of course, many in Lebanon are making or drawing up different scenarios. What should we do? How should we act? How should we behave? This is preoccupying the country, the issue of the Israeli threats. Now, in brief, we say that we can summarize the strategic situation which Israel is going through ever since the failure of July 2006 and the failure of the Israeli war on Gaza. We can describe the Israeli situation in the following way. This is our description. Our description is that the strategic situation in Israel is the following. Israel is now in big trouble. It is incapable of imposing peace, and it is incapable of waging a war. It is incapable of imposing peace and incapable of waging a war. Now, it's incapable of reaching peace. It cannot impose peace on its own conditions. What are Israel's conditions? For example, with Syria, they don't want to return the Golan Heights. And in the later stages, they, of course, raised this issue in the Knesset, and they spoke about a consensus on the Golan Heights. The same goes for the Shuba Farms, Kfar Shuba Hills, and the occupied Palestinian territories. So can the Israelis, after the developments which occurred in the last two decades, can the Israelis today impose on the Arab governments and on the Arab peoples? Can they impose a peace whereby territories are not returned? Can the Israelis impose a peace whereby Al-Quds, Jerusalem, is not returned? Can they impose a peace whereby the refugees are not allowed to return to their home? No. This game has ended, with all due respect to the Arab Peace Initiative, but this game has ended. The Israelis can no longer impose their conditions of peace on their understanding. They can't impose the Israeli type of peace. Today, there is also the problem of the partner of peace on both sides of the equation. This side says we don't have a partner. The other side says we don't have a partner. There is even incapability, as I said, of waging a war. Israel is now incapable of waging a war. What we are witnessing, what we've witnessed ever since the July 2006 war and ever since the war on Gaza, the maneuvers, the military drills, this is something natural because of the big failure of the Israeli military. The Israelis confessed very clearly that they failed in the war on Lebanon. They specified the aim, which was to destroy the resistance, and they failed. And the resistance is now stronger, and the Israelis themselves have confessed to this. But concerning to what Ehud Olmert wrote, and this will be published in Olmert's documents, Olmert also recognizes that he even failed in the war on Gaza, because the aim in the war on Gaza, as Olmert himself said, was to get rid of the rule of Hamas. And the war on Gaza failed to accomplish this goal. Today, the Israelis, when they want to launch a war, when they think of launching a war, this is a very important evaluation because it affects the answer. The Israelis, to launch a war, they need a very important condition, which is sure victory, certain victory, 100% certainty of victory, not possible victory. They will not wage a war unless they are sure of victory. They will not wage war on Lebanon unless they are sure or certain of victory. Certain 100%. The same goes for Syria, and the same goes for Iran. The Israelis, my dear brothers and sisters, ever since the July 2006 war and after the war on Gaza, after the repeated failures of the Israeli military, we've entered a new stage. I'm not trying to belittle Israel or its military capabilities. What I'm trying to do is to say that we in Lebanon and Syria, Palestine and Lebanon, we are strong to an extent whereby Israel cannot wage a war whenever it wants. So, it's not enough for Israel to have a high possibility of achieving victory. This is not enough for the Israelis. The Israeli military and all of Israel cannot put up with any other defeat, any other setback, because this would mean the beginning of the end. And in my view, the beginning of the end began in July 2006 in the war on Gaza. But any other setback means Israel is going down. And this is something which Israelis understand. I say, of course, and the Israelis confess to me, I say, and I'm not the first person to say this, but I am one of the people who always monitors the Israeli media, the Israeli comments, statements, and I always also listen and monitor the conferences being held by the academic institutions in academic Israeli institutions, whereby high-ranking Israeli officials speak, and all of those officials share one common factor. Israel can no longer launch a war which does not have guaranteed results. So based upon this description and this scenario in Israel, we reach the following conclusion. Our conclusion is that the Israelis today, at present, the Israelis have a problem in waging a war. For this reason, the Israelis are resorting to enhancing their capabilities. Of course, they're importing, they're gaining new military equipment, they're holding military drills and maneuvers. They have problems concerning recruiting soldiers. They had problems recruiting soldiers for the Israeli Navy, for example, and now they're addressing this. Slowly, they have problems with recruiting soldiers and problems concerning confidence or trust, confidence in the Israeli military, and they want to complete this process. And I'd like to tell you something. I'd like to say this to people in Israel as well. This issue of the Iron Curtain or the Iron Shield, this is just like a movie in the cinema, more than it's related to reality. Many Israeli officials say that this Iron Shield, is it really efficient? Is it efficient? And it's very costly. But even if it is efficient, its efficiency is extremely limited, this Iron Shield. The Israelis still need time to address their problems concerning the military issues, the tactical issues, their capabilities. On the other hand, the Israeli policy is to prevent the other parties from being ready and being prepared. How do the Israelis achieve this? For example, Syria, as time passes, Syria's strength is increasing. The same goes for Iran. The same goes for Hezbollah. The Palestinian resistance factions also, their strength is increasing day by day. And of course, this is against the Zionist project. So how can they prevent this increasing strength of these parties? They have three main means. The first means is to wage a psychological war, to terrorize. If you gain or possess these types of weapons, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. But I answer and say, we're going to gain these weapons and do whatever you want to do. If we haven't gained this weapon now, they threaten Syria and they say Syria is giving weapons to Hezbollah, and so they threaten Syria with a war, they threaten Iran with a war, they threaten the Lebanese government with a war. This terrorizing psychological warfare is to prevent the other parties from being prepared militarily, from being in a strong position. Second, they have the means of security to assassinate very important figures who participate in the readiness of these resistance parties. For example, the assassination of Imad Mughniyeh, the resistance, the Hamas official Mabhouh. Of course, Muhammad Mabhouh, the Hamas official, was responsible for the logistics and supplies to Gaza. So one of the means as well, the second means, is to target these individuals, targeting intelligence, security. The third means, the third alternative, is to create divisions. The Israelis have prevented the Palestinians from achieving reconciliation until now, and any Arab party which is preventing reconciliation between Palestinians is actually serving and collaborating with Israel. And these Arab parties know this. And look at Lebanon, the issue of divisions in Lebanon. For example, look at Lieberman. Lieberman also showed this Israeli plot. Lieberman went ahead and accused Hezbollah of assassinating former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri. Why? This is a clear Israeli plot. It began with the Der Spiegel magazine, now the Le Monde French newspaper spoke about it. Lieberman spoke very clearly. Now, what distinguishes Lieberman, and this is actually something good for us, he speaks what's on his mind exactly. He's very clear and transparent, and this is something very important. Let's really understand what the Israelis say, the way they think. And so, what we believe is that these types of threats, in general, these threats are more of a psychological war to terrorize the Lebanese people and the Lebanese government, and they also aim to terrorize the resistance in order to prevent the resistance from increasing its strength. And from the other side, they are also trying to boost the morale of the Zionist entity, the morale of society, of the society, of the army, and they are trying to convince the people on the podiums that Israel is strong and capable and is making these threats and is terrorizing, and they need this morale to be boosted. So one of their aims is to boost the morale internally amongst Israeli society and the army. One more angle to this is the issue of deterrence. 95% of the Israeli statements mean the following. They put conditions. If the resistance does this, we'll do that. If the resistance takes this step, we will take these steps. We will destroy, we will. So there's always the if. They're always putting conditions. So this shows that if they are really serious in what they say, they are afraid. At least, to the least extent, there is a political upper hand, a political plus for us. Before, Israel always made threats, and we were the ones who would say, if we will do this. But never before did Israel say, if you do that, we will do this. Today, it has changed. Israel is afraid, and it says, if you do this, we will do that. And this is unprecedented. Now, second of all, in this same perspective, of course, these threats, whether we consider the threats as part of psychological warfare or as part of Israel deterrence or a preparation for a real war, although I believe, we don't believe this is a very possible scenario, we don't think a war will occur anytime soon, but anyway, whatever the scenario be, how can we confront this situation? We have an example, or we have set an example in the resistance. We have a title. We must stand firm, we must stand strong, we must stand with courage, and we must make threats. On the other hand, we must counter the threats with threats of our own. This is the only way. Because if Israel feels that their psychological war has succeeded and people are really terrorized, the Israelis won't only make threats, they'll go ahead and actually launch the war. So to counter these threats with threats of our own, prevent the war, or at least delay the war, or make the enemy hesitant, especially if the threat from the other side is a serious threat, which the Israelis calculate for, and which the Israelis monitor in detail. We have an experience just a few days ago. Barak, of course, made a speech, and the statements or the words he said were not very clear when he made threats against Syria. And it seems that the Syrian reaction is not only related to the comments made by Ehud Barak. I think they're more related to messages which Israeli sent via certain envoys or delegations which visited Syria. And I think that the response by Syria is not just a response to Barak, but a response to the messages which Israel sent via foreign delegations to Syria. When Syria was informed of these threats, number one, it can express fear and back down and begin to reconsider its stance. On the other hand, Syria can make threats of its own, threats which are even stronger than the Israeli threats. And let me now speak very clearly and generally. The Syrian foreign minister, Walid al-Mu'allim, was the one who responded to the Israeli threats. It was not the head of the Syrian army or the Syrian president. Normally, the foreign ministry is the most diplomatic party in a country. Of course, as I said, the foreign ministry always uses diplomatic language and uses language which is not very escalated. But the Syrian foreign ministry was the one which responded, and I think this was done on purpose by Syria. The Syrian response said that if Israel assaults us, all of your cities will be subject to destruction, all of the Israeli cities. I am sure that the Israelis were surprised by the Syrian response. I am sure that the Arab governments were surprised by the Syrian response, because the Syrian response had no diplomatic language. It was very clear and transparent. But what was the result? Just 2 hours after Walid al-Mu'allim spoke, all the Israeli officials said, first of all Benjamin Netanyahu, then Barak, and then the other Israeli officials, all of them said, we had nothing to do with what Lieberman said. Barak corrected his own language, and the whole atmosphere in Israel was, no, our strategic aim is to reach peace with Syria. We don't want any war with Syria. This was only because of the response of Walid al-Mu'allim, the Syrian foreign minister. We're not speaking about something which happened 60 years ago. Will this approach succeed or not? It happened just a few days or a couple of weeks ago. So it's feasible now, such a scenario. Now let me speak about Lebanon. And listen to me very well here. In Lebanon, remember, Barak time and again made threats against Lebanon. He made threats of launching war against Lebanon. And he began to speak about a quick, decisive, certain victory. So the aim of the next war for the Israelis is to destroy the resistance and to destroy anything which is related to the resistance. This is the same aim of the July 2006 war. So the aim or the goal hasn't changed. But what is Barak saying? The next war, he's saying that the next war will be a war which achieves victory, not defeat or a setback. And this victory must be complete and decisive and must be clear, whereby nobody in Israel or Lebanon or any other place can express doubts in such a victory. The victory must be clear. And Barak also referred to another point, that air force power is not enough to reach a decisive victory. So for that reason, we will launch a ground invasion. And he threatened to use 5 ground military contingencies. At that time, we responded to him and we said, okay, whether it be 5 military contingencies or 7, and I'm just reminding you of what he said. And if you come to our territories, to our villages, to our valleys, to our mountains, the resistance pledged in response to these threats that these military contingencies will be destroyed in our territories. Now, after that, the Israelis began to back down and they began to stop using that language. Of course, we're not hearing from the Israelis any talk about a decisive, quick, clear victory. These terms are no longer being used. On the contrary, just a few days ago, the head of the Northern Israeli Military Command said that in any future war, we must specify very moderate goals. So the goals have decreased in level. Barak himself, I think just about 1 or 2 months ago, he used a term which I used, I think, on the day of the martyrdom of Imad Mughniyeh. I don't remember exactly, but what he said was the following, and I quote, "If you look at the Lebanese borders, the Lebanese southern borders, it's calm, but if you looked over the border, you will find tens of thousands of Hezbollah's fighters who are ready and are monitoring the situation." So, Barak, is he quoting what I'm saying? No, but he has information. He's speaking about the information he possesses. He knows the Hezbollah fighters are waiting on the border. When I say that we are ready to fight in every valley, in every mountain, in every village, I cannot trick the Israeli, because the Israeli side can collect information. The Israelis do have capabilities of collecting information. The spy networks in Lebanon is a very big issue. Everywhere it's a big issue. And day by day, we uncover the magnitude of this. So when I make these threats to the Israelis, and when I don't have information to back it up, the Israelis will not care and won't monitor what I say, but they pay attention to what I say because they know that what I say is true. They have information that what I say is true. So when we confronted the issue of the quick decisive victory and the five military contingencies, they resorted to a new language. The new language was the theory of southern Beirut. They called it the theory of southern Beirut. Now, you must know, especially the inhabitants of southern Beirut is now a word which is being used in military dictionaries and military schools. What is this theory? The theory is that we can destroy southern Beirut. If we can destroy southern Beirut, we can destroy anywhere, we can destroy any place. Of course, southern Beirut is a stronghold of Hezbollah. Now, the accomplishments of the Israeli Air Force during the July 2006 war, this is the most which the Israelis can accomplish, meaning what the Israeli Air Force destroyed in July 2006, this is the most, this is all what the Israelis can do from the air, from their Air Force power. On the 14th of August last year, we responded to the Israelis, and what did we say? We said, okay, in the previous war, we said, if you strike Beirut, we will strike Tel Aviv. But if you wage a war, if, we don't want a war, but if you wage a war, I'm saying if, so that no one in Lebanon can say that we have this, we make decisions of war and peace. Not because we're afraid, we miss the war, but we don't want the war. Not just, we cannot say we just don't want the war, but we also miss the war. We said that if you strike southern Beirut, we will strike Tel Aviv. We also said this. Now, when we said this, they began to look deeply into these statements. First of all, it was settlements, northern Israeli settlements. Now it's Tel Aviv. So the Israelis paid a lot of attention to this. What does this mean, to strike Tel Aviv? Of course, most of the Israeli population is on a coastal line, after Haifa, through to southern Tel Aviv, 10 kilometers or 15 kilometers. I think in width it gets to the widest part towards Al-Quds, Jerusalem. In that specific part, we have the oil wells, we have the factories, we have the population centers, we have the institutions, governmental institutions. Everything is in that specific area. And so I have one additional point here. I want to speak about this point in detail. They might believe that when we say we will destroy Tel Aviv, that they will, if they destroy southern Beirut, we might put holes in some walls in Tel Aviv. Many won't cause severe destruction in Tel Aviv. But what I'd like to say today, no. If you destroy buildings in southern Beirut, we will destroy buildings in Tel Aviv. So, this is the second title, the second issue, the issue of the theory of southern Beirut. Now, when they found that nothing could really affect the resistance, when they make the threats to us and we respond by saying, okay, we welcome these threats, go ahead and we will confront you. And when they say, we will destroy you, when we respond and say, no, we will destroy you. So when they were always countered with these threats, they went ahead and made the threats to the Lebanese people and government, and they threatened to destroy Lebanon's infrastructure. Now it's a new equation. We have a new equation. I'm going to speak about this new equation now. They spoke about the infrastructure, and they said that in any new war, we will destroy Lebanon's infrastructure. Okay, now let's also refer to this. In Lebanon, we have infrastructure. In occupied Palestine, we have infrastructure. We have 1.5 airports, let's say. They have many airports. They have many harbors. We have a few electrical plants. They have many plants for generating electricity. We have a few oil wells. They have many, many oil reservoirs or oil wells. And we have some factories, but they have areas of many factories, areas full of factories. The infrastructure in Israel, the Israeli infrastructure, is a lot bigger and a lot important, a lot more important than the Lebanese infrastructure. In the July 2006 war, I don't know if you can get it, the Israeli television in July 2006 war, when electricity went off in one of the Israeli cities, the Israeli government was preoccupied because they can't live without electricity. So when we lose electricity, of course, when electricity goes off, this helps us to confront the war of Lebanese infrastructure, because we're used to it. That's what I mean. So infrastructure for Israelis is a lot more important than it is for the Lebanese. Electricity is in Israel 24 hours a day. It goes off in Lebanon. So what I want to say is the following, and they can try and look into my remarks. They can try and verify what I'm saying, if it's true or not. What I want to tell the Israelis, not if you strike southern Beirut, we will strike Tel Aviv. No, if you strike the airport of the Marty Rafik Hariri, if you strike Beirut International Airport, we will strike Ben Gurion's airport in Tel Aviv. If you strike our harbors, we will strike your harbors. And if you strike the oil wells, we will strike your oil wells. And if you strike our factories, we will strike your factories. And if you strike our electrical plants, we will strike your electrical plants. Today, on this occasion, the commemoration of the memory of Sheikh Raghib Harb, Haj Imad Mughniyeh, and Sayyid Abbas al-Musawi, I announce that we accept this challenge. We in Lebanon, we are a people and we are a resistance and we are a national army and we are capable by strength to protect our country and we don't need anyone in this world to help us to protect Lebanon. In this way, we confront these threats. Threats are confronted by these promises which we make. We do not confront threats by backing down or by hiding or by being afraid. We confront threats by being clear, by standing firm, and by being ready, and by making threats of our own. And I once again would like to assure you, we do not want a war, and we never did want a war. We are a resistance which was fighting to liberate its territories and its detainees, and we never wanted a war. But we are also, of course, we also know it's our duty to defend our country and to stand firm on our territories and to preserve the dignity of our people and of our ummah. Now, one question remains, my dear brothers and sisters, on this occasion. One question remains, avenging the martyrdom of Imad Mughniyeh. I'd like to tell you very clearly, some Israelis said that Hezbollah might go ahead and take some small step and, of course, specify a certain target. What I mean is they will look for some small figure and strike this figure or kill this figure and okay, we've avenged the martyrdom of Imad Mughniyeh. But no, this is not the way we will approach this matter. I'd like to tell you, throughout the last 2 years, we had many moderate targets which we could have targeted, but we did not go ahead and target them. Why? Because we are avenging the martyrdom, and this is a very clear word, we are avenging the martyrdom of Imad Mughniyeh, not just anyone. And we know what the aims, and we know the time and the place, and we know the operation which would really mean avenging the martyrdom of Imad Mughniyeh. We know the operation which will tell Israel, this is our response to your killing of our jihadist leader, Imad Mughniyeh. Nobody can put pressure on us. This is our stance and our enemy is worried. Let our enemy remain worried. Let the enemy worry at all the times, at all places, everywhere. But we are the ones who will choose the time, place, and target. And today, on the annual anniversary of the martyrdom of Imad Mughniyeh, I'd like to tell you, and to all those who love Imad Mughniyeh, is what we want is to avenge the martyr Imad Mughniyeh by targeting someone who was at the same level of Imad Mughniyeh, at the same level on the Israeli side. We don't want to avenge for the sake of just avenging. We want to avenge to protect all of our leaders and all of our fighters and the cause in general, which is represented by Imad Mughni. My dear brothers and sisters, on this commemoration, on this holy, blessed occasion, we will stand with you and we'll take this responsibility together with Sheikh Raghib Harb, Sayyid Abbas al-Musawi, Hajj Imad Mughni, who many people got to know after he became a martyr. God willing, we will be able to continue on their path and to fulfill their promises. And I'd like to tell all of our martyrs, be assured that the flag which you raised will remain raised high, and the road which you opened will remain open, and the cause which you were killed for will be fulfilled. The cause will be fought for, and we will achieve this cause. We will achieve victory. We are your sons, we are your students, we are your brothers, and we will achieve your dreams and fulfill your dreams and your aspirations, God willing. You are in paradise, and you are with the prophets. You will be rewarded, and you are rewarded by God. And be assured, our colleagues, you have left behind you students and people and brothers who are honest with their pledge to God. Some of them have sacrificed, some are waiting, and they will continue to walk on this path, my dear brothers. Of course, I express my condolences on this occasion. Thank you for being present, and may God accept this from you, and may God preserve you, may God bless you, may God achieve victory for you, and assalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.